This is episode 403. You know those recurring fights you have with your wife or your husband? Those topics that you always bicker about? Or how you're always running around after everyone else, and whenever it's time for you to do something for you, it just kind of never ends up happening. Relationships like this sometimes end in divorce, but worse is that many of you here will end up living lives of silent desperation, wishing things were different, having given up on the relationship and yourself, but not having the courage to do anything about it. If your intimate relationship has any part of it that is stuck in a shitty pattern, has communication issues, or needs to change, then I think this episode, well, you'll get a lot out of it, because we talk with a clinical psychologist about how he navigates the challenges in his own marriage, how he manages his own inner chaos so it doesn't negatively affect his wife. And he gives us a lot of very practical tools and examples that will help you fix and heal your relationship based on what he has done in his. It's such a vulnerable episode with loads of real stuff that I think you'll really like. So let's dive in.
Welcome to the How to Not Get Sick and Die podcast. You've tuned in because you want to start taking your health seriously so you don't, well, get sick and die. Here we talk all things health, nutrition, and human optimization. Let's jump into it with your host and resident scientist, Maddie Lansdowne.
What's up, my healthy friends? Good to have you back on the airwaves with us here today, where this year it's my mission to coach 500 people to get control of their sugar cravings and sugar binges so they can stop yo-yo dieting, stop obsessing about food, and finally create a body that they feel confident being in. And if anything I just said resonates with you, then the links to inquire about whether or not we can help you are in the show notes down below or in the caption. So scroll down, click the link, and let's chat. Now, here with me today, we have, back by popular demand, Dr. Richard Chambers, whom was previously on episode 249 and 353. This epic conversationalist is a clinical psychologist, formerly an associate professor at Monash University. He's a psychedelics expert, a mindfulness expert, and has published a handful of journal articles. And to top it all off, he's also a TEDx speaker as well. Richard, my friend, how are you?
Great, Maddie. Really good. And great to be back here chatting with you on your podcast.
Yeah, likewise. Our conversations get some good comments on Spotify. So we've got to have you back to have more of that kind of conversation.
Yeah, well, they're really alive, aren't they? I always love chatting to you on your podcast and in real life. You know, it's so good just to go where it takes us. I really enjoyed the chats.
Yeah, I was in the car today driving around listening to some of your stuff, sort of trying to garner some inspiration. And then I sent you a message and I was like, what should we talk about? And then I've got a bunch of dot points, but we hit on a topic that I thought would be at least a good place to start. It was sort of on my list and relevant to my life at the minute, but also relevant to yours at the minute. And that is like marriage and relating and connecting with our intimate partner and or partners, depending on your, you know, choice of lifestyle. So maybe we can start somewhere in that realm.
Great. Well, I just got married, so that'd be a good place to start back in July.
Firstly, congratulations.
Thank you. And you know my lovely partner, Aliza, too.
Yeah. Give us some juicy goss about what happened. Where was it?
Nice. Well, I've been living in Bali in Ubud and long distance relating with Aliza. I'm about to move back to Melbourne. That's a whole other story. But yeah, we had the wedding in Ubud and it was kind of a concept wedding in a way. We just went right off script and made it up. And one of the things, like, I love weddings, right? Like weddings, like champagne, dancing and love. I mean, that's a great combination. Who's not going to be into that? But when I go to weddings, as much as I enjoy them, I always kind of feel like I'm consuming them. I always feel like a bit of a consumer. And I always see the poor bride and groom rushing around having exactly 2 minutes and 12 seconds with each guest and looking totally stressed and not in the moment. And so I pitched to Aliza really early on, like, why don't we create like a festival or, you know, let's give ourselves multiple days. So we had 3 days. And for two of those days, we had 25 of our besties fly in from around the world. And then on the final day, another 25 people joined us just for the ceremony. Wow. And so those 3 days, we did a whole bunch of exercises to really drop in together. So we started off with going to a water temple here in Bali. Everyone got naked immediately. So that just dropped us into our vulnerability. And then we had a whole bunch of my partner, like Aliza is a tantra teacher, a sex and relationships coach, epic human being. And so we kind of joined, did a mind meld and we curated this program where we did men's circles, women's circles. I went off with the men and got a transmission of healthy masculinity from them. Aliza went off with the women Then we switched. So I went and got a transmission of the feminine from the women and vice versa for Aliza. We had ecstatic dances. We had blessing circles. We just did a whole bunch of processing. And the whole point for me was that the wedding was not just about us, but was about everybody. My unofficial tagline was everyone's getting married. And that led up to an exercise right before the ceremony as we were preparing to come down and have the ceremony on the third day. The facilitator for Freudian slip, our celebrant / facilitator, ran an inner marriage ceremony, inviting people to find two parts of themselves that were like in polarity and not integrated, and then find a way to integrate them. And so as we came down, we'd had these 3 days with our friends, inviting them all to co-create the wedding with us as well. So we had like a friend was the celebrant, two other friends were the MCs. One of my best friends, Ben Templestep, was the DJ. And so everyone just kind of stepped up and offered something, because a lot of our friends are fantastic facilitators or space holders or performers. So many people contributed. And by the time we came down after these 3 days, this inner marriage ceremony, everybody was so dropped in their bodies, connected to one another and open-hearted, that we just came into this beautiful space where we were able to just be fully present and fully authentic. And yeah, it was just a wonderful experience. And then we threw a few funny things in, like we did a couple of skits of shadow improv. So a lot of our friends kind of project onto our relationship and kind of look to us as like a model for how to relate. And there's a lot about what Aliza and I do that is inspiring, and I can understand that. But, you know, we want to show them that we have just shadow dynamics playing out like everybody does. So we acted out a couple of them. I played Aliza, she played me, and we played out a couple of our funny dynamics. It's like a comedy skit. We wrote each other a song, which was super beautiful. That was Aliza's instigation there. But we wrote a song. Mine's up on Spotify, actually. I got super inspired and recorded it, chucked it up on Spotify. So I just did a lot of things differently and created an experience for everybody, which then supported us to have the deepest possible experience of the marriage. So that's what we did.
That's incredible. What an experience. And I can imagine a lot of people listening are thinking, whoa, like that's a next level thing. And it's interesting because I guess I'm here in Melbourne, very much quote unquote stuck in the rat race. Sure, I don't go to a corporate job anymore, but I'm still trying to hustle, still trying to win and climb. And I guess maybe the default assumption in culture in general, maybe, but that I feel is that like marriage is sort of like a box that you tick to say I've reached this level of grown-upness. And my parents are happy about it. And society says that my marriage photos should be probably in my cover photo on Facebook. And so it feels very like just a milestone you're meant to get to because that's what's expected of you. But the way that you've sort of described this festival that happened, it sounds much more reminiscent of fun and love and expression and connection rather than a box ticking event that everyone's going to pay the bank back for in the next 10 years.
Yeah, well, we were aiming for that. I mean, I could imagine that a marriage might be a box-ticking ceremony for some people, but certainly for us, it was so much more than that. And in fact, we felt like we were married. I actually dropped, like when I was giving this kind of, when we're giving the intro speech at the start of the ceremony day, we're kind of talking about our relationship and what we stand for and how, you know, basically what our relationship means. I said, hey, everybody, we actually got secretly married 7 years ago. And everyone was like, oh my God, what the hell? I'm like, actually, it was more of a spiritual marriage. When Aliza and I first met, we actually went away and took some psychedelics and just dropped into a deep place of really feeling it, like the depth of our connection. So we had the wedding 7 years to the day after that, just a nice 7 year cycle. But you know, we've done so much processing and worked so hard and done so many things in that 7 years that we couldn't imagine really feeling much more united and married. And we thought, is this just going to be like not a box ticking, but like just a, I don't know, like an acknowledgement of that or a celebration of that. But yeah, but to stand in front of our best friends, I mean, the people that flew in to Ubud in Bali, obviously, you know, were really people that wanted to be here. And to stand in front of them after everyone had cracked wide open, and to just fully embody the truth of who we are, just being witnessed in that was super powerful. and inspiring for others and inspiring for us. And it does feel different actually coming out the other side of that. It feels like something's been, we've shown the world like who we are and what we stand for. And that feels very powerful.
Is it a degree of social accountability that comes with that, standing in front of people you trust that you know will hold you to account and proclaiming a status or a standard or a commitment that is part of what has shifted?
Yeah, I guess that's part of it. I mean, it was just, to be honest, if I'd just done that ceremony with Aliza and no one else there, maybe the celebrant to kind of lead it, that would have been a powerful experience in and of itself, just to stand in front of my wife, my beloved, and just acknowledge, like, this is what we stand for. This is who we are. This is what's playing out in the shadows, but this is what I'm marrying you as and what I'm marrying in you. Even that just would have been a really powerful thing. But then to show everybody that, and to do it in such a balls out authentic way that there's no way you could fake that. You could never write the vows that we wrote or do the shadow improv or sing the song if you were just kind of making it up. Yeah. So the social accountability piece, yeah, it's a big part of it, just to have that witnessed and just to have our friends reflect back to us what they see and what they love about us as well was just beautiful.
And I guess I'm curious as well, because you and Aliza, you know, have been obviously been together for some time. Did anything change which led you to say, oh, I want to get married? Or was it one wanted it more than the other? Or you both were working towards that sort of public commitment ceremony type thing?
Yeah, one of the challenges or problems that I had in all my relationships up to Aliza was just not being fully committed and being all in. Mm-hmm. I always was just like mostly in but a little bit out. And so when I met and seen how that just used to trigger like my own avoidant attachment and not being fully committed would just trigger the insecurity in my partners and get into a really really dysfunctional dynamic. And I did that relationship after relationship. I've had like three significant relationships before Aliza. And so going into the relationship, I was like, all right, I am going to be all in all the time on this relationship, no matter what. And really early on, because she was in Australia on like basically a tourist visa, and she's like, hey, can we like start the process of temporary residency and stuff? Because she didn't want to have to keep going to this. She was doing like a dance class, a contemporary dance class as a way of being in Australia. And so she asked me, and the first step was to register the relationship. And so 3 months into our relationship, she's like, can we register this in the eyes of the Australian government? And I was just like, absolutely, let's do that. And then she said, can we apply for TR through a partnership visa? And I'm like, not only can we do that, but I'll pay half. And I just went kind of all in. And so from early on, I was like very committed to doing this. Mm-hmm. And then we got engaged after maybe 2 years, and then COVID happened and no one was getting married. So we were engaged for like 5 years, mm-hmm. which is kind of sweet in and of itself, because it's a nice phase as well to be in. But so it was kind of leading up to that, but we were well and truly ready to get married by the time we did it.
Yeah, wow. That's an incredible story. And I'm still wrapped up in the whole festival idea. I'm thinking about my future now. But I'm relating as well to what you're saying about not being fully in and into previous relationships and sort of having one foot out. And, you know, I guess I'm in a relationship now where I'm all in because we're having a child. And this has been, and for me, you know, if I self-observe enough and look at my shadows enough, I can identify that that's probably what I needed to call me to account, you know, to hold me to a standard,
yep.
You know, because now it's like, instead of the little boy or the teenager or even the young 20s guy that's like, oh, I'm pretty good with my words and I've got access to every opportunity and life's pretty good. And, you know, why doesn't this party just never end? Now I'm consciously and unconsciously thinking, well, what kind of role model do I want a young boy? And we don't know what we're having yet, but a young boy to be, you know, if it's a young boy. And I guess vice versa, what kind of man would I want a daughter to grow up and seek, you know, in her own behavior, you know, in her own searching for a man? And so, it's been so interesting to see my own change in like, whoa, maybe the earlier than expected baby scenario in our relationship had to happen because that's what I needed to, you know, actually be all in and be held to a whole different level of accountability in that regard. But what do you think it was for you that was holding you out of fully committing before Aliza?
Basically, childhood wounding would be what I describe it as. I mean, I can't remember if we talked about this in a previous podcast, but I'm very aware of parts or what it, sub-personalities, how we're comprised of a multitude of different parts. And I work a lot in my coaching now with a model called Internal Family Systems, or IFS, which is getting more and more well-known. That's just a rebranding of other, you know, therapy slash personal development models, going all the way back to Gestalt therapy, which I think arose in like the 20s or something, the 90s. So there's this awareness of parts. We have different parts of ourselves. We have these inner child parts, which get wounded. And I'm not talking about, you know, heinous traumatic incidents. I'm just talking about like little moments throughout our lives where some part of us doesn't feel safe, doesn't feel seen or acknowledged, and then sort of contracts and sort of hides a little bit and then sends a protector part to compensate or to keep it safe. Mm-hmm. And so I've got parts of myself that were wounded, not seen. Like my parents split up when I was 10. I bounced backwards and forwards between them. I'm actually doing this processing with my own coach and therapist at the moment, like processing some of this stuff, because I have these parts that were really wounded by my parents' divorce and then having to go backwards and forwards between my parents. And so some part of me couldn't deal with that. And so sent these protective parts where I would just kind of like, I'd jump on the bus on a Sunday afternoon heading back from my mum's house to my dad's, and I would just like grab my Game Boy, grab a book, totally space out in relationships. I just had this part of me that was like, it wasn't conscious. These parts operate in the shadows, but the logic of it now that I've seen it is it's not safe to be all in and to fully love someone, because if you lose them, you're going to get really hurt. Let's just be in enough to keep people around because I want to have these relationships, but not fully let go, because that exposes me and makes me vulnerable and can get me hurt. Interestingly, of course, it's a childhood logic that is running that model. Like when I see the story, I'm like, that doesn't make any sense, you know, rationally, because first of all, I'm way too deep. I still have this part active now. Like this part, it's still in me. I just see it for what it is and I don't let it run me. Mm-hmm. But it used to be so loud. But when you look at the logic, like I'm way too far down the line with a Lisa. Like after the first year or two, I was already so invested that if we'd broken up, it would have deeply hurt. And yet this part's like, oh, don't commit too much because you could get hurt. And then the second thing is that causes problems. Our protectors are doing their best, bless their little hearts, like to keep us safe and help us navigate life. But they often cause problems and often they get us the opposite of what they're actually trying to achieve. And so me being partly out of relationships throughout my life, like I said, it would trigger the insecurity in my partners. Ultimately, they'd end up leaving me or we'd just, you know, and so that just wasn't working out. So it's been a really important part of this whole journey is to see that I have this particularly one part that's like, oh, I don't want to fully let go and to work with that. And having shifted that and worked with that, it's still part of me. Like I said, it hasn't gone away. And in fact, we don't ever want our parts to go away. We just want to form a relationship with them so that if I start having, sometimes I get a bit judgmental or perfectionistic or critical of Aliza and some of the things she does, or I start thinking these thoughts like, you know, maybe I'd be happier somewhere else, or I might meet someone who I find really attractive and start to be like, I wonder what if. And rather than like buying into that and causing problems in the relationship or being scared of that and being like, oh my God, that's not an okay thought to have, and pushing that back into the shadows, I'm like, hi, I know you and I hear what you're telling me. And I also understand that that's not really who I am, and I don't want that part of me running the show. So that kind of inner work has unlocked the ability to actually be more in the relationship. So I hope that makes sense. That's kind of where it came from.
Yeah, that was incredible. Thank you for sharing that. And as you were talking there at the end, it reminded me of when I heard, I forget who, but they were talking sort of about stoicism and sort of, I guess, the comparison of the stoic mentality in the context of relationships and up against sort of the Disney effect, or the effect that movies have on us, and this idea that, you know, you're meant to be happy and excited all of the time and super loyal and never have a thought about another woman or another man, or, you know, and the reality is, and the stoic person that was speaking sort of said, the reality is that maybe 3 days a week you really love your partner and maybe 2 days a week they really piss you off, and it's like that for the whole 50 or 60 years, and that's normal and that's okay. And it was just this idea at the time for me that was like, oh, like I'm not meant to be absolutely besotted for the rest of my life all of the time. And if I'm not besotted, in that moment, I shouldn't be bringing into question the integrity of the relationship.
Yeah, I really like that idea, actually, the whole Stoic philosophy, normalizing the fact that relationships aren't always going to be a honeymoon phase and sweetness mm-hmm. and light, and there'll be challenging times. So I like that much of it. Mm-hmm. I think there's a very important extra step, which is that if those 3 days a week, 4 days a week, let's say those 3 days a week, you're not happy, I would invite curiosity around that. Like, what is going on in those times? Because there's something that's cooking, right? And I think this is a good frame for relationships. We could ask, what are relationships for and why do we do it? And there's a whole lot of reasons for that, like raising kids. Congratulations again. Financial stability, security, having a team, someone on your team who can help you navigate life. There's so many reasons why we can do it. But relationships are also a crucible for self-development, right? Because let's face it, everybody has basic human needs. And if we're single, we're often just at our best because we're just looking out for number one. We're doing what the hell we want. We're taking care of our needs. We tend to feel good. Not always, but we tend to feel good most of the time. Then we enter into a relationship with somebody else who has a separate set of needs. And now, whether we're doing this consciously or unconsciously, we're entering into a conversation about how we get our needs met. And, we experience, they're a pretty typical, one of the shadow improvs I played out with Aliza was my avoidant attachment with her anxious attachment. So I'm always focusing on when I'm lost in these parts of myself, I'm just working too much and I'm just kind of watching stuff on screen, whatever. And Elisa's, she's Italian, extroverted and anxiously attached, which is a perfect storm. She's always, not always, but she's often wanting connection with me. And so she'll come to me and she'll be like, hey, let's chat. And I'll be like, oh, actually, I'm in the middle of something, or, I want to just have my own space, my own time. So we used to fight about that early in our relationship. So I'd come home from a busy day at work, having done things that for an introvert are pretty difficult, being on stage and presenting keynotes and running workshops and facilitating and doing therapy and all the things. And I just need some downtime. And I'd come home and she'd be like, hey, you're home. She's like a puppy dog. Amazing. Let's chat. What do you want to do? And I'll just be like, oh my God. And I wouldn't speak my need for a little bit of downtime. I would just kind of resent the fact that this puppy was, I'd kind of like it and kind of resent it. And then I would either just go off and do my own thing, or I'd try to be present, but I'd just be half there. And so realizing this and applying frameworks like nonviolent communication, which is one of the best frameworks we've discovered for communicating through a language of needs, we'd recognize, okay, I've got a need for space and downtime in this moment. You've got a need for connection. No one's right. No one's need is more important. We're in a relationship where we're trying to get both of our needs met as best we can, as much of the time as possible. So how do we navigate this? So now I'd come home and I'd be like, some days I'd walk in, I'd be like, oh, this beautiful puppy dog, I can give her my time and attention. Other days I'd come home and I'd be like, hey, babe, I really hear that you want to hang out, but I need a little bit of downtime. I might just go meditate, might go do a workout, something that just gets me back in my body and back in my parasympathetic nervous system, and then I'll come and connect with you. And so we started to negotiate these needs. And so stepping back from what I'm saying, relationships are a crucible for growing, they're for personal growth. And if we don't grow, the relationship stagnates and basically either just becomes a life of quiet desperation, or it ends for various reasons. So I would take an extra step from the Stoic. Yes, let's normalize that it's not Disney, but at the same time, let's look at if we're having those unhappy days, what's happening inside? We might want to have some curiosity about that. Is there some part of us that's running the show? Are our needs not being met? When our needs aren't being met, we feel bad. We feel negative or unpleasant emotions. So with that kind of lens of curiosity and seeing relationships as a crucible for personal growth, I think we can take a really important extra step.
It reminds me of the business / financial advice that I've heard, which is that nobody makes as much money as a single man unless the single man's married, or unless the married man has kids. The married man with kids makes the most amount of money, or that has the greatest success, because he's he can be more of himself. He's forced into personal development, or he has to choose consciously to fix things because there's more people that are affected. And I think I completely agree that, it shouldn't be a balance between happiness and devastation. Possibly it's sort of a bounce between happiness and neutrality, or, you know, just sort of peaceful coexisting that sort of happens occasionally. Because, yeah, obviously going the whole 50 years where 3 days a week you hate your life, that's a, you don't want that. You don't want that.
That sounds like a literal ball and chain, doesn't it? Which is, of course, the joke that some people make about their marriages.
Classic euphemism. No, this is an interesting conversation. The one thing that I want to, I guess, bring up, thinking about sort of a lot of listeners have said to me, because my partner, Yali, who at this point has been on the show, which is awesome, she's a relationship coach. And so, you know, and works in that space of masculine and feminine. And so a lot of people have said to me, and clients particularly, that sort of get a little bit of a view of behind the scenes of my life, they're like, oh, I would love to, you know, be a fly on that wall. Or equally, you know, where do you find men that don't have to necessarily be quite a psychologist like yourself, that have the ability to navigate emotional conversations, understand, you know, women's needs? And so I guess all of that, bringing that to sort of a question for the listener, which is, where does somebody begin talking to their partner to be able to enter a conversation where they might learn about somebody's needs or their shadow parts, you know, knowing that the average man's just gonna be like, no, I'm fine, mate. Don't worry. I'll get over it. You know, that kind of, which was me 5, 10 years ago.
Yeah, we've all been there for sure. So the best entry point would be the work of Marshall Rosenberg and a framework called nonviolent communication, often called NVC. And the guts of NVC is learning to drop to a language of needs and communicating needs, and then respecting the fact that people may or may not meet your needs, but they're much more likely to meet them if you clearly articulate what they are and why they're important, right? And then give them the autonomy to meet those needs however they want to meet it. So we're not making demands. We're not using guilt. We're not, you know, using criticism, which Marshall Rosenberg would call violent communication, right? And he's not just talking about yelling and screaming and making death. He's talking about, you know, anytime we're communicating our needs indirectly and trying to get our needs met, he would call that violent in the sense that it creates division and separation and often results in conflict, mm-hmm. which can look like fighting. It can also look like withdrawing and shutting down and stonewalling. So when we switch to nonviolent communication, simple framework, let people know like what's happening objectively without the story. Simple to in principle, but really challenging. So describe the situation objectively, name the emotion we're feeling, describe the need underneath the emotion, and then make a request that the person meets our needs. Right. So if I break that down, so I walk into the house and Elisa's like, oh my God, you're home. Yay, let's hang out. And I'm like, oh, God damn it. And I'm like, babe, just get out of my face. Like, you're annoying me, right? There's just like a demand with a judgment and whatever. Or I'm like, oh, why are you so, God, you're so needy. Like, just can't you just like, just give me a bit of space? Like, God damn it. Like, what's wrong with you? Making her wrong, judging her, using guilt to manipulate her to pull back, right? Whereas I might, if I was objectively describing the situation, I'd say, hey, babe, I'm noticing I've just come in the door. I've actually had a pretty big day and I'm noticing that I'm a bit depleted, or I just need a little bit of my own time, right? And then maybe describe an emotion. Like, I might just say, look, you know, I'm just feeling a bit like depleted would be a way of describing that. Then articulating a need. Really, this is probably the most important step, and saying, what I need right now is just a little bit of time to reconnect with myself. And so therefore, what I'd like to do, and now you sort of link a need with a strategy, what I'd like to do is maybe just go meditate for 30 minutes and then come back and we can, you know, decide what we're doing for the evening. And so rather than jump to the strategy, which is like, hey, babe, I'm just going to go and do my thing and I'll be back in 30 minutes, right? We've actually named, why is that important? I feel a bit depleted. I've had a big day. I really feel a need to reconnect with myself and I'm going to come back after that. So we're letting the person know what's important, right? Or another, you know, like another example would be, if I just think about like, you know, coaching clients, you know, like so many examples come to mind. So, you know, just communicating a need around, you know, safety, for instance, like psychological safety, relationship safety. One of my like corporate clients I was working with recently discovered something on his wife's phone that like didn't like, it wasn't a transgression, but it didn't look particularly good. And so he felt unsafe. And so rather than like judging and guilt tripping and you can never message that person again, or like, why would you do that? Like, I can't believe it. Rather than playing that game, which so many people would play by default, I want to normalize this. We don't get taught the NVC skills. So of course, that's the toolbox that most people have. What I was coaching him to do was to express, okay, I've noticed these text messages and I'm feeling hurt and a bit angry. And actually underneath this, I'm feeling unsafe. Like, I feel unsafe when I think you're interacting with people like that. And what I would like, or what I really need here, is to feel a bit safer. So I'm wondering if you could maybe not exchange messages like that with this person. And you make it a request. I mean, if that person decides that, no, I'm going to keep messaging everybody I want, however I want, down the track, you know, you might also decide that you've got some boundaries. If your needs aren't being met and you're feeling unsafe all the time in your relationship, you might want to do something about that. Right? Leave, or make it really clear that you're not up for that kind of behavior. But the first step was just to say, you know, I'm wondering if you could help me feel a bit safer, because I want to feel safe in this relationship. I'd like both of us to feel safe, and you not communicating in that way would help achieve that. Would you be willing to do that? And so you create, I call it a clearing. The metaphor I use is a clearing. Like, you're in the jungle, you're in the bush, you're walking around trying to relate. You don't know where each other is. You keep bumping into sharp stuff and bumping into each other. And then one person expresses needs and makes a request. You step into a nice clearing with fresh air and sunshine and flowers. And it's kind of appealing when you say to someone, I would love us both to feel really safe in this relationship. And I'm interested in creating that with you. And I'd really appreciate it if you created that with me. And here's a way to do that. Would you like to meet me in this clearing? And it just makes it, you know, maximally appealing for people to meet you there. And they know that stepping into that clearing is going to maybe require some inner work, but it's also going to contribute to the well-being and aliveness of the relationship, going to contribute to their partner's well-being, and ultimately it's going to be a good thing for them too. You know, maybe looking into, why do I need to have these flirty text messages? I don't know why I need to do that. Like, you know, seeking approval, or, you know, you might go on a whole journey with that, maybe even get some therapy or coaching around it. You know what I mean? So we create a clearing and you invite someone to step into it. And so you're inviting them into life. And that's the essence of NVC. It's a language of life, of aliveness, rather than the deadening judgments, demands, guilt trips, etc.
Yeah, that's fantastic. And I think the thing that I took from what you just said fundamentally is that it's I statements, right? It's a talking from your position about you rather than the projection of anything sort of outside of yourself. It's like, this is how I'm affected. This is what I need.
Yes.
Which I think many people would react, and possibly maybe women more so, the idea that saying and speaking that way is selfish. And obviously a lot of people know the line, self-care is not selfish, but there's this maybe conditioning or wiring that's like, oh, if I speak about myself in that way, then I'm, yeah, that like I'm taking away from the family, or I'm not showing up in a way that I'm expected to.
Yeah. There's a big difference between expressing needs and being needy. Sometimes my clients bump into that objection. They're like, hang on, you're talking about expressing my needs, but isn't that being needy? Or their partner says, you know, tries to sort of weaponize it and say, well, you're just being needy. But using I language and expressing, like, this is what I need in this relationship. These are some ways that you could meet those needs. And I'm going to leave it up to you whether you're willing to do that or not. But I'm going to clearly keep communicating what I need and asking for it. I would flip the script on what you just said, because that's almost like the least selfish thing that we could do. Because, like, let's take a look at the alternative where we're focusing on you. I mean, how do I talk to you then? Like, you should be doing something different, or, you know, like, I don't know. If we just own our own stuff and acknowledge our own basic humanness and our human needs and then articulate them clearly, it's actually very not selfish. And it's letting our partner know as well where we're at. Because we don't learn this stuff in school. I mean, dude, I was at a principal's conference recently. I was standing in front of 1,000 school principals running a workshop which was based on nonviolent communication to enhance collaboration and innovation in their school community. And I'm like, hands up, who's heard of nonviolent communication? It's been around decades, man. No hands went up. 1,000 principals. I was like, oh my God, how? Like, we're teaching social emotional learning. Are you maybe calling this something else? But that's how much we're not learning this stuff in our families or our schools. And so it's you know, I'm glad to be talking about this on your podcast because I know you've got a big audience and I'm really hoping this is resonating with some people. Just grab Marshall Rosenberg's book, Nonviolent Communication. I'll make some resources available, like some online resources if you want. I've got a blog article on this. I've got some videos and different things that might support your audience. Because when we kind of start to practice this, it's just taking full responsibility for ourselves and it's being human in a relationship and it's not expecting our partner just to figure out how to meet our needs and then being pissy at them for not doing that, which is what so many of us are doing. And it's not using kind of like manipulation and guilt trips and kind of violent speech to achieve those aims. It's just doing it in my opinion, the most mature, healthy way possible. And then, of course, you know, we recognize we've got needs and our partner has needs and even our relationship has needs. Or when I do my corporate work with teams, you know, the team has specific needs, the leader of the team has needs, the organization often has organizational needs and values and boundaries we could throw in as well, you know, needs and values sometimes a bit related. So we start having conversations openly about like, what do we need? What do we value? What do we want? How do we find a way to get our needs met as much as we can? And that's probably, I think, the least selfish way of having a relationship, you know, compared to just kind of expecting our partner will do the things we want and then being annoyed that they don't. And then we're not really interested in our partner's needs and we just kind of try to get away with as much stuff as we can. And, you know, and unfortunately, that's how a lot of people seem to be relating. And again, just because it's nothing wrong with them, it's just a skill set that we don't learn.
So picture this, right? Unlocking your potential, conquering emotional eating, and gaining insights directly from a health and nutrition expert such as myself. That's what we do inside the Healthy Mums Collective Facebook group, which is currently free to join. If you've ever felt trapped by food challenges, struggled with maintaining a healthy lifestyle, or yearned for a community that understands the reasons why you've yo-yo dieted for years, then there's a new chapter waiting to be written. And this is your chance to start writing it by joining us all on Facebook Lives, on engaging posts that push you out of your comfort zone and into growth, and Q&A sessions with me. All of this works as a platform to begin changing your emotional eating problems for good. Oh, and also, as a special gift, you receive my transformative How to Turn Food into Self-Confidence ebook. And that's also for free. I get it. Skepticism might linger. You might think, Maddie, I've heard these ads and I'm not sure. Well, at least a quarter of the members inside the Healthy Mums Collective Facebook group have been paying clients of my emotional eating program at some point over the last 3 or 4 years. So if you're not sure, you can post in the group and ask to find out if I'm the real deal or not. It's totally up to you. To join us in the free Healthy Mums Collective and to end your emotional eating and feel good in your own skin and begin that journey, pop down to the show notes below, click the link and breeze through 3 simple entry questions. Join today and let's embark on a journey of growth and empowerment. The link is in the show notes below.
One of the things that sort of brought me into this world of nonviolent communication and, you know, was on my own therapy journey, but it was the realization for me that whether I have needs or not, I go about like fulfilling those needs in either a really destructive, painful way or a healthy, mature way. Like the result is the same, right? I have those needs met no matter what. And so the realization of like, so I just, even if I pretend I don't have the needs, even if I don't talk about it, whatever, I then go and do something catastrophic or horrific or horrible to have the same need met, which then comes with a big dose of guilt. And then I've been stuck on this cycle since I was about 5 of like, that you get your need met and then you pay for the need by paying in guilt and saying sorry and sucking up. Like that's the loop that I was kind of on. It's like, that's the only way you get your needs met, right?
Yeah.
But when I realized, I was like, I could either do that and destroy everybody's lives in the process and my own, or I could, you know, start communicating in a different way and have the same need met without the guilt. I was like, oh my God, this is like a hallelujah moment.
Game changer. Yeah. Game changer, isn't it?
So, and I think the way that it shows up for a lot of people is, you know, whether it be their sugar addiction or their alcohol issue or their perpetual fighting, that they're sort of addicted to that loop, or it's all they know in their relationship, you know, it shows up in all of these unhelpful ways. But I also noticed that as I began to communicate in a way that meant that the guilt punishment and all of the punishments that came as a result of what I did, I felt now unsafe in the healthy space because I was so conditioned that the guilt and the heaviness and the pain and the hurt and the tears, like that was all part of it. So once I removed that sort of automated section of getting my needs met, I was in a place, I was like, oh, when's the guilt coming? Where do I pay the toll for having my needs met? And so that felt really unsafe to me for a while until I practiced it enough times that I was like, okay, yeah. I don't think the boogeyman's going to jump out anymore.
Yeah, I can fully resonate with that. And so to pitch another resource to your audience, there's another really good book called You Are the One You've Been Searching For. It's written by Rich Schwartz, who developed the internal family systems framework that I mentioned. This is like a self-help book for couples or for anyone in relationship, looking at that the way your parts interact with other people's parts and create a lot of the conflict and the problems that we have, and then giving you a strategy for coming back to your true self, which is sort of at the center of all of your parts. But what you're describing there, and I think this will be interesting for your listeners, is that, you know, the part, like when we are abusing sugar or screens, or when we're judgmental and critical, or when we're holding back in some way, I mean, any of those kind of dysfunctional behaviors that we know on some level probably isn't what we want to be doing because it's not serving us in the long term, that they are parts, you know. So the IFS thing talks about, okay, you've got your inner child parts, they're called exiles, but your inner child part that's been hurt, that's been wounded, where its development's kind of been distorted or crystallized or stopped in a sense, and then it sends its protector parts, and they split into managers. Managers do pro-social, like socially acceptable, not pro-social, but socially acceptable stuff. That's your perfectionist, your achiever, your people pleaser, that kind of stuff, right? Or even the critic, the inner critic, you know, if we criticize ourselves enough or judge other people enough, this kind of helps us to manage life. So that's mm-hmm. the managers. Then there's the firefighters. So when underneath there's some little part that's feeling insecure and its manager's doing the best it can to manage, but causing us, you know, burnout and stress and all the things and inflammation in the body, when that all just gets a bit too much, a firefighter part shows up just to hose it all down. And that's the, you know, the dissociator or the addicted parts. And Gabor Mate talks about this a lot as well, that underneath any addiction is trauma. And just a little side note to hear, most people think of capital T trauma, accidents, assault, war, etc. And that's part of it. But most of us are more familiar with the small T traumas, which are just being like, you know, getting in trouble at school, being bullied at school, friends being mean to us, parents not being there for us, a parent's divorce, a little bit of neglect, not being seen or validated or acknowledged for who we are, parental perfectionism, et cetera, right? All those kinds of things. And this is drip, drip, drip. The capital T is the tidal wave coming and just washing everything away. And then you've got that drip, drip, drip water torture cutting through the rock. That's the small T trauma. So underneath any addiction is some kind of trauma response, or through the IFS lens, we'd say some little exile part is unresolved in some way and it sent a protector to manage or firefight, and that ends up causing secondary problems. And that's what people come to coaching, you know, most of the time for help with. They don't know it, but that's what brings them. When I used to be a therapist, anyone turning up, the symptoms were the activity of their parts, their firefighters and manager parts, or you could say the symptoms were attempted solutions to an even deeper problem that you then get caught in. So there's nothing wrong with, you know, eating a little bit of sugar, you know, or watching a bit of TV or having a drink of alcohol. I mean, of course, the science now is showing actually some of these things are pretty bad. But, you know, you could say, like, let's just take a step back and take a breath. There's nothing inherently wrong with any of those things. But if they are coping strategies for dealing with internal distress and we don't have any other way of being with that distress, we've got to keep relying on the sugar, the food, the alcohol, the gambling, the screens, whatever it is, and then they become addictions. And so for so many of your listeners, because of the nature of your podcast, if they're caught in some addictive behavior, like for me, I'm watching a lot of TV at the moment, and I know that's a coping strategy. I'm long distance relating at the moment and I'm away from Aliza, and that brings up all my stuff, and for her too. And so we're both working really hard to not be that. And so I keep noticing, you know, I'll come home, finish work, whatever, and then I'll just like watch 2 hours of Netflix. And I caught myself doing that last night. I'm like, you know what? I'm not doing that today. Today I'm going to just be with whatever the freaking hell is going on inside and just bring some compassion and some mindfulness and just some presence to whatever that is, because that's a healthier way of relating to my internal distress than that addictive behavior. So I'm hoping that makes sense to some of your listeners, and they might even start to sort of be curious. You know, if you put the addiction aside, when I used to do my therapy work and I talk about coping strategies, there's nothing wrong with coping. Coping's good. It's better than falling apart. But if we're stuck in a coping cycle, which is about avoiding something deeper that we need to look at, we go through life just coping, and then we're half alive and we have those addictions and we keep eating the sugar and the food and doing all the things. And it's only when we're willing to, and we don't want to give up the coping strategies. I used to counsel people, and I'd counsel your audience too. You know, hearing this, if this is resonating, don't just, I'm going to take a night off to look within, but don't just quit. Don't be like, okay, it's a coping strategy, eating sugar. I'm going to completely stop that cold turkey, because you'll come face to face with stuff that's probably going to be pretty difficult to manage. So what if you eased off? Or what if you replaced that coping strategy with something a little bit less problematic, right? Like exercise, or, you know, because anything can be a coping strategy if we use it to avoid discomfort and it becomes problematic. Heaps of people are addicted to exercise, and you've got like extreme, like David Goggins type people in the world. Like, so what if you just either replace that coping strategy with something a bit more functional, or just slowly eased off, but were ready and prepared to, you know, just knew ahead of time that there's something deeper down that you're going to need to face. And the best tools for facing that are mindfulness and self-compassion. So whether you do that yourself through some self-help stuff, or whether you maybe find a good coach or therapist and start to do that work, and then you learn to be with the sort of the deeper parts of yourself in a healthy way, and then they start feeling kind of, and then you don't need the coping strategy so much. And so then you can choose whether you work or exercise or eat sugar or any of the things, but you've got some agency and flexibility around it.
Yeah, I think that was a beautiful share. And I think as well, in this high-paced world with kids that do 24 sports and 3 instruments, and, you know, like so many people, their coping mechanism is being addicted to the stress, you know, and oh, I don't have time for myself to do any of that stuff. And it's this narrative that sort of is supported and perpetuated by our fast-paced culture, where it's really a convenient and helpful thing to be able to act as the firefighter, right? Or it's more of that other side, I would imagine, the manager, because it's socially okay, yes, right? To be able to be busy, and I'm a giving mother and I'm a giving wife, or I'm a providing father. But you peel back just one layer and it's like, oh, we're almost at breaking point now, because we've been on this roller coaster for so long that, you know, it's sort of, you're always simmering, you know, the boil over is never far.
Totally. And let me name a common dynamic that'll resonate with a lot of your listeners. You feel insecure. Maybe you haven't faced that, but you feel like on some level you believe that you're not good enough, you're not enough. So then work becomes a way of proving your worth, and you tie your success and achievement with your sense of self-worth. So then you're playing that game. I've done this, and a lot of my coaching clients are saying, you play this game. So then you go into work and you're working really hard. You're getting secondary gain. You're getting approval and external validation, and you're making money and you're getting promotions and your lifestyle is really good. And so you're playing this game of trying to compensate for feeling inadequate, but then you start feeling stressed and burning out. And then rather than facing what's going on, you start reaching for alcohol or sugar or any of the things, just, and that's the firefighters coming in just to hose down the heat and the intensity of that manager running things, that perfectionist and achiever ganging up and just running the show. And then you realize, and if you're lucky, you realize, oh, okay, so I don't want to keep doing this firefighter behavior. I actually want to, like, oh, now I can see my manager. And why is my manager working so hard? Oh, because deep down I feel insecure, right? Mm-hmm. This is a common dynamic, and one that I've worked through myself. Or feeling unsafe in relationships. You know, you feel unsafe, and so then you try to get safety. So you become controlling or judgmental, or you hold back, like I said, and then that starts to cause relationship distress. And then you'll go out drinking or just like zone out next to your partner on, you know, scrolling on your phone while watching Netflix, or some behavior that then, of course, makes the relationship worse and worse. And if you catch yourself doing the scrolling or the drinking and go, hang on, what's going on? Oh, why am I so controlling or judgmental or critical or people-pleasing or rescuing? You start to realize, oh, because deep down I don't feel safe. If I'm not doing that, and this comes back to what you said before, you know, when you step out of those protective layers, you come back in touch with what's actually going on underneath. And initially it does feel unsafe. That's why these protective parts, the managers and firefighters, have been running the show most of our lives. And when you get back in touch with kind of who you really are and what's going on, it does. It feels really exposing and vulnerable and unsafe. But that is the first and most important step in resolving this stuff. Whether you do it with self-help books, mindfulness, self-compassion, internal family systems, nonviolent communication, whatever, or whether you work with someone professionally, you know, just coming back in touch, it does. It feels really exposing. I remember having a big breakup with my partner before Aliza, and I felt broken coming out of that relationship. I really felt like I'd co-created a lot of the problems by being not all in and triggering her deepest insecurities. And she was very good at just like fighting back in dysfunctional ways, caught in her parts. And she was extremely intelligent and kind of had me feeling like I was broken and defective and like I was never going to be able to have a proper relationship with anybody. And I came out of that and I found myself, ironically, at this big meditation course festival thing. And I started flirting with people and partying a little bit. And I was like, oh, hang on, I'm just doing the same compensation. If I can get some external, if I could find a partner and just be charismatic and fun here, I would not have to face this deep sense of like I feel so insecure. It was really funny. Like I was in Germany at this massive like meditation course, tantric Buddhist meditation course. So we used to party, drink and meditate our asses off. And there was like 5,000 people camped on a hillside in Munich, just out of Munich in the south of Germany. It was like a Buddhist Woodstock. And it was a party, all these European babes and everyone from all over the world coming for this annual course. And I'm so happy it was on a meditation course because I caught myself. I saw myself flirting and being funny and charismatic and all the things that I'd always used to compensate for feeling inadequate. And I had this moment, I'm like sliding doors moment here. I can easily play this game and I know where that goes. Or I could just be what I really am right now. And so when people would say, how are you, man? I'd be like, actually, I feel really insecure. I'm really struggling at the moment. An interesting thing happened. Half the people there, the spiritual bypasser crowd, could not freaking deal with me and had nothing to do with me, like I was a leper. And the other half of the people met me in that place. And I had this amazing experience of having really deep connections. It was only for like 2 weeks, but I had these deep connections with women who I wouldn't normally be attracted to, right? Because I'd normally be like, where's the babes? And now I'm like, I'm not playing that game. And I actually dropped in properly with some women. And all these alpha dudes who I'd normally be like competing with, they could tell, I think they could sniff out, hang on, that's weird. This guy's like an alpha, but he's not playing that game right now. That's kind of weird. And so I had these really deep connections with these dudes. And I spent the time just crying and feeling into what was there and learning, you know, mindfulness, being with that sense of inadequacy, that part of me that believes he's not enough as he is, and bringing some self-compassion, you know, some soothing touch, giving myself the message, it's okay, it's normal to feel insecure. Everyone has this, you know, just the normalizing, the common humanity of it, reassuring that part, you know, you're enough as you are. There's nothing you have to prove. I'm here. I did that, basically what I just described there, for 6 months. And after 6 months, I started feeling like, this is just human and normal to feel inadequate at times or defective, like there's something wrong with you. And then I started looking around, I could see it everywhere, every single person I encountered, from the most messed up therapy client that I was working with to the most apparently successful, high-functioning person. I could just see the way they were playing. I mean, not everyone. Like I think some people feel genuinely secure and have secure attachment and feel good about themselves. But at the heart of everybody, and this is what Tara Brach speaks to, and this is what Brené Brown speak to, like at the heart of everybody is this sense that there's something fundamentally flawed about us. And everyone has this. And when I realized that, I just had this overwhelming compassion for everybody. I'm like, oh my God, we're all in this together. And that just changed the way I related to myself. It changed the way I taught meditation and mindfulness, changed the way I did therapy and coaching, and then led me to paths like nonviolent communication, which is AKA compassionate communication, speaking to the parts of people that feel like they're not enough, not worthy of asking for their needs, communicating our needs and just owning that we have them and that we have emotions like, you know, insecurity and anxiety and whatever. And that's totally normal. So it was a big moment, man.
Yeah. Wow. Thank you for sharing that. And it's interesting you mentioned the spiritual bypassing, because I had a conversation with a complete random stranger at a dinner that Yali and I were at on the weekend about just the whole concept of spiritual bypassing. And yeah, the movement of health, wellness, spirituality, meditation, you know, it's got a lot of spiritual bypasses in that community. So it's always nice when you can, I guess, firstly identify them, but find your people that are going to actually sit in the shit with you and sit in the mud with you and see you for who you are and show up in a way that's supportive. And I think in many ways, it's been the core of this conversation today, which is, you know, making sure you're connected to or have access to people that are going to sit in the mud with you and see you and witness you and support you in that space. And of course, us, them. So no, I appreciate you sharing so much of your own story and own experience today. And I think, you know, to hear a clinical psychologist, it's been an associative professor, you know, talk so vulnerably and open, I think a lot of people are going to just extract a lot of goodness out of this conversation. So thank you.
Yeah, it's nice. I've always gone out of my way to let people know that I'm just a human being, you know, even though I am the clinical psych and the academic and the mindfulness guru and all that stuff. And it's just really refreshing for people. And this is why Brené Brown's, you know, initial TEDx went viral, because she's just like this. And then she's just like, you know, but this is who I am and I'm just going to wing this from TED Talk. And it just resonates, because it's nice when people realize that. And yeah, and I'm hoping that your audience is also hearing that there are ways of moving beyond this stuff. This has been a lifetime journey for me. It's not complete. It'll be at least for the rest of this lifetime resolving this stuff, right? So, but it's, you know, I've had some big moments. And so discovering mindfulness, discovering self-compassion, discovering the existence of inner parts and sort of the self-relations and voice dialogue and internal family systems framework. Psychedelics has been, you know, I've talked before about that, all these things. And then being in relationship with someone who's committed to meeting me in not parts and not in unconscious dynamics, just acknowledging that's part of who we are. This was our vows together. And this is what I speak to in the song that I wrote for Aliza, like acknowledging this is, we bring our shadow parts, right? And that's part of it. I accept yours, you accept mine, but that's not who's getting married today. That's not in the sense that I don't expect you just to be okay with all of my unresolved baggage, and I'm not just going to tolerate all of yours. I'm going to lovingly, with presence and compassion and patience, help you see what's playing out in you that's triggering stuff in me and this infinity loop of dysfunction. And maybe we could both commit to stepping out of that and being something else in relationship. And so that's what I stand for, both with Aliza, but with everybody in my life. And when I'm working with individuals, companies, that's what I stand for, you know, like people being genuinely authentic and compassionate and present and just having a different kind of relationship.
Yeah, that's beautiful. Thank you. Thank you for being you, because we need more, you know, men in this space that are able to communicate like you and lead the way, you know, that are presentations of healthy masculinity. And I think, you know, it's a very confusing space to be in. And I don't want to start a whole other rabbit hole conversation on that, but I just want to acknowledge you for being you. And where, I guess, can everybody else find you online? Where can they get your stuff? Where are we sending them?
So drrichardchambers.com, drrichardchambers.com is just the best place to start. That has got links to all of my academic articles, my books. I've got a book called Mindful Relationships I wrote a few years ago. So that's got some of these principles distilled in it that's available as an ebook there. I've got some meditation. There's a whole bunch of stuff there that people might find useful, as well as obviously a contact form and my contact details if people want to reach out and get in touch. And I'll make some resources available. I think I'll give you that link. And I've mentioned a couple of books. So I think if that's the kind of thing that you do, I might give them to you so you can link them in the show notes. And then I've even got some online resources that people might find useful, you know, practicing nonviolent communication.
Yeah, happy to. I'll put all of those in the show notes below or the caption below. So for anybody that wants to check it out, scroll down, click the link, jump into Richard's world. And maybe I'll contextualize this final question, which is, what is one piece of relationship advice that you wish more people knew about?
Yeah, nice. Yeah, because you've asked me that before, right, in previous, like what's one piece of health advice? Relationship advice, that the relationship we have with ourself, and by that I mean with our parts, really shapes, or you could say is the relationship that we have with other people and with the world. And so if we are not aware that we have all these different parts inside, we're not going to notice that in other people, and they're going to be deeply confusing and annoying and triggering for us. And if we have that awareness, it's like, oh, this is what's happening, right? And my parts have this way of interacting with your parts, and parts are contracted by definition. So we're going to have a contracted interaction. And then when I acknowledge that and start to do some inner work, and if I bring presence and compassion to these parts and help soothe them and, you know, heal them and get their needs met, and then use nonviolent communication to help other people do that, that's just like, that's the foundation of healthy relating. So, you know, vulnerability, mindfulness, self-compassion, nonviolent communication, these are just powerful tools that I wish I'd been taught in my family and in school and throughout my life. And I'm glad to have discovered them, and I'm happy to be mentioning them to you and your audience today. And hopefully this is going to start some people's journeys on that path.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I guess that's why people listen, right? They're looking for answers, looking for pathways, and hopefully we're able to give it to them. So, but thank you so much for being here. Appreciate you, your energy, all the episodes we've done, and no doubt the many that we will do. So thank you.
You're welcome. I love being a guest on your podcast. These conversations are so alive. Somehow we just get in the zone and talk about the real stuff. So thanks for inviting me on. It's a real privilege.
No worries, mate. We'll catch you really soon.
Cool.
Hey, thanks for listening to the show. If you enjoyed this episode or learnt anything at all, the gift of your 5-star rating would be incredibly helpful. And what's even more powerful is if you write a review. You can do it below each episode on Spotify, every time an episode comes out, and inside Apple Podcast, simply find the main page of this show with all the episodes on it, scroll to the bottom, hit write a review, share your amazing feedback, and then hit send. It helps this show grow tremendously and allows me to successfully invite bigger and more famous guests each time we do the show. Thank you, thank you, thank you for helping us climb the charts, climb the algorithm, and help more people. Oh, and by the way, I have a short disclaimer as well. I just wanted to quickly remind you that the information provided on this podcast is for general informational purposes only. While we strive to bring you accurate and up-to-date content, it's important to note that a lot of this is mixed with opinions, stories, and ideas not supported by mainstream science or medicine. Any advice or suggestions should not be considered a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Always consult a healthcare provider before making any decisions about the health and wellness of you and your family. Remember too that what works for one person may not work for another. And just as we promote on the show, each person is responsible for their own health decisions. Thank you for tuning into the How to Not Get Sick and Die podcast. And now, the next episode. Here it is.